Madam Chair and members of the board, back to my school district and members of the board. Senators, it's a pleasure to be here this afternoon. My name is Dave Metzen, Office of Higher Education. We thank you for this invitation, and there's three parts to what we're going to be doing here today. First, we're going to talk about the supplemental budget as recommended by Governor Plenty, and then we're going to describe in detail the state grant program, and the last piece we'll be talking about the Achieve Scholarship Program. Senator Pappas, we were talking a few minutes ago about the challenging times that we're all facing in the state of Minnesota, the $1.2 billion deficit. College enrollment, as everyone knows, is way up. That's good news. Thousands of people are going back to school that are unemployed or want to develop new skills, which is good. They're trying to get retrained, be ready for the economy, and hopefully as the economy turns around, they're going to learn new skills and be more employable and have a career that is very rewarding to them and to their families. As we've studied the budget situation around the country, it probably comes as no surprise that just about every state in the country is facing challenging times financially in higher education. Probably the only exception is North Dakota. But we recognize that in order to stay competitive long term, we need to consider new and innovative ways to keep our educational system strong. We have to be flexible and dynamic as we go forward. And I think the DNA in the culture of Minnesota, the legislature, and the education of the state, that's been our history and that will be our future. To do a good job going forward, be flexible, innovative, and look for creative ways to solve the problems in front of us. The four parts we'll be talking about, as I mentioned earlier, we're going to review the budget proposal for higher education from the governor. We're going to walk through the proposed cuts to financial aid programs administered by the Office of Higher Education. And following that, we'll review key information about the shortfall in the second year of the state grant program. And finally, we're going to address the Achieve Scholarship Program and some of the issues and some of the recommendations coming from the governor's office. Madam Chair, does that meet with your approval?
That's fine. Why don't you proceed?
Mark. Ms. Cannis, will our financial director and director of research from the Office of Higher Education walk us through the first part?
Madam Chair and members, again, for the record, my name is Mark Michikans with the Office of Higher Education. You have this document, I believe, in front of you, but I'll just work off the slide screen here. The first slide, and I'll give the numbers, but if you have some more pointed questions, it could be directed either myself or to Director Metzen. The first slide, again, shows for the systems the governor's recommendation for reductions. It was announced yesterday. And in those recommendations is a $36 million reduction, a little bit more than that, for the University of Minnesota, and about $10.5 million for the Minuscu system. These two figures, Madam Chair and members, bring the system's appropriations down to the 2006 level. That's a limitation that could not go below that given the requirement of maintenance of efforts in last year's federal stimulus bill. And that is the reason for the big difference between the two numbers as well. Obviously, the universities is more than three times the size of Minuscu's, but it does bring them both to that level of 2006. So that's the rationale behind that recommendation. Madam Chair, I'll just move on then. To the Office of Higher Education and the recommendations there. We approached this. We tried to put some principles together at the front end before we made any recommendations to the governor's office and to the management and budget. And there is a couple of them. One is we wanted to minimize the impact on financial aid on students. We think that that is the primary objective of the work of the office, and that to the extent that we could minimize that impact given the budget situation, that was an important goal. We thought hard about the second one, and that is if we had to make reductions, perhaps it's best to look at things that are of more recent changes, newer programs, newer parameter changes, if you will. And that's across the board. Of course, there's been changes the last session that we'll talk about in a few minutes about in the state grant program that were addressed. But even beyond that, in some of the other programs, work study, child care, you'll see that the recommendations are actually based on new money that was added last spring. And the idea being that students, institutions were probably more accustomed to the old, I want to say the old base numbers, if you will, because they had lived with them for a long time, and that the change would not have that large of an impact. And then one word that was not on the list, let me mention, Madam Chair, is that we wanted to make sure that we distinguish clearly between permanent changes or need for permanent changes and one-time changes. And again, when you get to the state grant, you'll understand that better. But we didn't want to make the mistake of recommending changes in parameters that would lead to permanent reductions in aid when we didn't need to, because there are some one-time issues in the state grant program.
Chair?
Senator Wieger?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Michikanis, when the governor overall made the supplemental recommendations, I believe he also looked at some assumptions federally on anticipated projected revenue. I believe under Medicaid, $387 million or so. Keeping in mind that President Obama mentioned the infusion of funds for community colleges, and there could be other higher ed implications, are we also using similar type projections as was done for Medicaid to address higher ed?
Madam Chair and members, no, we are not in this budget recommendation. If you recall, when the President released his budget, a week and a half or so ago, there were a number of changes on the Pell Grant side, but those are would not be affect this biennium. They're for 2012 and going forward. So we didn't rely on that at all here. Changes that were in current law enacted last year and prior were already built in the projections we made last spring, and they are contained in this as well. But nothing that's been recommended is included here, only things that were enacted into law.
Okay.
But just for the record, Madam Chair,
Senator Wieger.
Just for the overall consistency, the federal Medicaid match, that hasn't been enacted yet, has it?
No.
And you know, I'm just, you know, it's okay on Medicaid for a projection for one-third of our budget balance, but for a higher ed projection not being included. So I just wanted to try to understand that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Senator Wieger, if you can understand Medicaid, I would applaud you. Madam Chair and the members, what you have in front of you is this and the following slide is kind of some detail on reductions in each of the various programs that are within the purview of the committee. I think most of the members know, but let me remind you that roughly 2.5 months or so ago, a memo came out from management and budget directing us to identify reductions of 3% in administrative funds and 6% for program funds for fiscal year 11, and for fiscal 10, we were supposed to identify the same reductions for unspent money as of December 28th of last year. So anything remaining in fiscal 10 was essentially available for budget reduction in the full amounts for fiscal 11. So I'll walk through these, Madam Chair, and you'll see the amount, both the amounts for 10, 11, and the percentage cuts from the base level. There was identified a $233,000 reduction in the state grant, and that's tied directly to the summer program. And the thinking here was that was not yet awards that had been made to students, and so promises were not made. There's no reduction on the spring term of the state grant program. And then the following year, a reduction of slightly over $2 million for fiscal 11 in the state grant program, roughly 1.4. So this was a figure that was at, I would say, on a percentage basis at the low end of the reductions. The next reduction, the state work study, again, fiscal 11, $2.5 million. And, Madam Chair, as I indicated earlier, this is the new money that was added last year annually, which is why it was identified here. And, again, that's why the percent cut is so high relative to everything else, is because it was considered new money. The post-secondary child care, the same issue. It's $500,000. Again, it was a new infusion of funds and resources in the last session. The Minitex and Minlink programs, that's just a straight across the board 6% reduction as directed in that memo. The emergency grants, the $150,000, this is $100% reduction in that second year. And Madam Chair, perhaps at some point along the way, we'd like to have Minsky respond to this, but it was our thinking that the amounts that went out per institution were so small that it wasn't clear to us what was occurring there. So that's why that recommendation is there. Interstate tuition reciprocity and the Indian scholarship, again, in both cases, there's a 6% reduction in accord with the earlier mentioned memo. The savings plan match, we took a bit more out. There is some extra funds in that appropriation. So both for the current year and the next year, we took some funds, recommended some fund reductions. ICAP, it's the same kind of an issue. United Family Practices, that's a 6% reduction here. And then Minnesota Minority Education Partnership, MMEP, for $3,000. That's, again, a bit higher percent reduction, but that's just a rounding because they only get $48,000 in the appropriation anyway. So, Madam Chair, then continuing on the next slide, this is more the administrative area. The office's administrative reduction is 3%, again, as I mentioned, in accord with that earlier memo. MEC, Higher Education Compact, is recommended a $3,000 reduction.
Mr. Connors and maybe Mr. Metzen, how can you do that? Don't we have a contractual responsibility to pay our MEC dues? Which have not gone up, I think, in 4 or 5
Madam
years.
Chair, I don't think there's any contractual obligation per se. They had raised their dues from $92,000 to $95,000, I think, 3 years ago.
Mm, right.
And at that point, we didn't ask for an appropriation change of $3,000, thinking it was simply too small. So we kind of ate the difference. And then I think you came back last year with the chair of the House and added that money back. In all honesty, Madam Chair, our thinking here is that everybody else has taken a reduction, and it might be appropriate for the compact to do as well. I'm not sure how that works out in practice. We pay them in the spring of the year, which is why there's money available for this current school year, or fiscal year, rather. And then the other remaining administrative area, and this is administration, both for student and parental information and the GEAR UP match, again, 6% across the board. You see the total, though, Madam Chair, members, $619,000 the first year and about $6 million the second, or a total reduction to the agency programs administration of 3.3%.
Any questions then about the governor's supplemental budget?
Madam Chair.
Recommendation. Senator Erickson-Ropes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you very much for the presentation, and I apologize if I'm still asking some rookie questions here as I try to settle into this. Did the governor's supplemental budget take into consideration any of the recommendations in the OLA's report about that came out on higher education and administrative spending?
Was this the central office of Minsky report that we were supposed to hear last week and we got bumped because of session?
Never mind.
It's the central office from Minsky.
Yes.
Right. It's a good question, so save it for when we have that discussion.
When the right body's before us. Thank you.
Chair.
Senator Roebling.
It was my understanding that there would be a 6% cut across the agencies. And so I'm wondering about agency administration, how that got spared the 6%.
Mr. Mishkanis?
Madam Chair and members, we were directed to take the 3% initially. That difference, the other 3%, was part of the governor's recommendation Monday, but that has not yet been allocated to the agencies. There was some lack of clarity, I guess. I think the intent of management and budget is to try to find some cost savings in the IT areas and with space and rent spending to meet that target. And to the extent they cannot meet that target with those cost reductions, they would allocate the difference to the agencies. But it's not clear yet how that allocation is going to occur. I assume it would be based on our appropriation relative to the total, but it's not clear yet. So we haven't been spared it yet. It just isn't clear yet.
Mr. Mishkanis, you were unallotted last summer. How much were you unallotted?
Madam Chair, members, it was $77,000 last summer.
And how did you cope with that? Where'd you get that money?
Madam Chair, we have had a number of open positions that we simply haven't filled. There's a couple on the research side. There was one auditor's position.
One outreach.
And an outreach position that just occurred in the last few months. So we simply have not filling positions.
Okay. Any more questions on the governor's recommendations? Okay, why don't you continue then with the state grant?
Madam Chair, as Mr. Metzen indicated, there's two parts here following the state grant program and the ACHIEVE program. And in both cases, let me just a real quick overview. One is Because the numbers are so large and there's some controversy involved with some of these issues, we wanted to make sure that a good background was provided to you, especially for members that may not have been involved in the detailed conversations in the past, that you were made aware of the changes made last session and what you knew back then and what's occurred since. So we want to make sure that our information to you is complete and as full as we can make it. And with that, Madam Chair, I'll turn things over to Ms. Fergus.
Madam Chair and members, for the record, my name is Meredith Fergus, and I am the policy analyst for the Minnesota Office of Higher Education, specifically for the Minnesota State Grant Program. We wanted to start out just by going through a little background. The Minnesota State Grant is a need-based grant. Students apply for it by completing the free application for federal student aid. Through that single application, they can qualify for both the federal Pell Grant and the Minnesota State Grant. Students must be Minnesota residents, attending Minnesota institutions, and be U.S. citizens or eligible non-citizens. Last year, we awarded $143 million to just under 85,000 students. The average award was about $1,700 per recipient. One in three Minnesota resident undergraduates receives a Minnesota State Grant. This chart displays the amount of money that goes to students by income level. At the less than $10,000 in adjusted gross income for families, they receive approximately $68 million in federal Pell Grants, and that is supplemented with $23 million in Minnesota State Grants. As the Minnesota State Grant and the federal Pell Grant are coupled together, the Minnesota State Grant is kind of applied on top of the federal Pell Grant throughout the income level, but then also reaches up to the $70,000 level for those middle-income families. Last year, during the legislature enacted several changes to the program. These changes were mainly the result of a change in the federal Pell Grant program. The American Reinvestment and Recovery Act last year provided for a $619 increase in the maximum federal Pell Grant. In addition to that, the College Cost Reduction Act added a supplement to the federal Pell Grant program that is slated for an increase next year. Both of those increases together provided approximately $69 million in savings for the Minnesota State Grant Program. That savings was reinvested into the program in the following ways. We increased the living and miscellaneous expense allowance from $6,200 to $7,000. We increased the four-year tuition and fee maximum from $9,838 to $10,488. And we increased eligibility from 8 full-time semesters or the equivalent to 9 full-time semesters. We also added the Summer Transition Grant, which was a bridge program that provided grants for low-income students needing remedial coursework during the summer prior to their freshman year in college. The one thing we did not provide for in those estimates was a spending buffer for the economic uncertainty.
Madam Chair, if I could remind the committee, last year when the governor's recommendation came before you, given the size of the federal Pell change, I think we had left somewhere around the range of $5 and $5.5 million on the bottom line, so to speak. Because we were uncertain, and I think both bills actually came to conference with similar amounts of money in their grant proposals. And obviously, as we talk in a few minutes, that would never have been enough to cover any kind of shortfall. And I might add
to
that.
Did we end the conference committee with that still that amount of $5 or $6 million?
No, Madam Chair. In fact, I think
spent
we had not only spent it, you spent a bit more than it. So.
Madam Chair.
That's typical. You go to conference committee, you don't, both sides get both what they want. Right, so it increases overall. Yeah. Senator Tomasoni.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On this first slide here, how does the $143 million to 84,500 students in 09 compare to 08?
It should be about the same. Ms. Fergus?
Madam Chair and members. In fiscal year 08, we actually provided for approximately $145 million, $146, so slightly higher. And the number of students is approximately the same. Fiscal year 08 saw 83,200 recipients. And the average award was slightly higher at $1,786. So
Average award in 08 was a little higher?
Yes.
And did we do anything to make it a little bit lower in 09?
Ms. Fergus.
Madam Chair and Senator Tomasoni, whenever we make changes to the parameters, they do affect the distribution of income. Given that we provided for monies to that extra 1,000, 1,500 students in 09, that is what brought the average award down, because the appropriation level stayed approximately the same.
And, Madam Chair, did
Senator Thomason.
Did the students, as a result of the LME allowances and some of the other things we did they end up getting more money on the bottom line?
Madam Chair, Senator Thomason, yes. When you look at the students combined, federal Pell Grant and Minnesota State Grant, yes, average awards did go up.
Did you include LME when you answered that question?
Ms. Fergus.
Senator Thomason, yes.
Okay.
The LME did provide an increase directly to the grant of students.
Okay.
Madam Chair, if I might add, the average award actually has gone down slightly over the last 2 years. If you were to look at those numbers for fiscal year 07, we had 80,000 recipients and average awards of $1,900, so a slight decline from 07 levels.
And the decline is due to more Pell Grant money and more students?
Madam Chair, the decline is actually due to how we split money that biennium. Fiscal year 07, we were actually running a slight surplus, so the spending in that year alone was $156 million. When you net that out across those 80,000 students, they saw slightly higher awards in fiscal year 07.
Because the LME adjusted to accommodate that. That's
exactly.
Right. Okay.
Madam Chair and members, what I'd like to do now is kind of walk through the spending estimates for the biennium. The top line you see on your screen is the appropriation level. The state appropriation for the state grant program is just over $144 million per year. In addition to the state appropriation, we would normally allocate approximately $1.3 million in federal LEAP and SLEEP funds. For fiscal year 10 and 11, those funds were transferred to the ACHIEVE program. So the line you see is strictly the state appropriation. The next line you see is the spending projection base. That is the spending we projected at essentially the end of session last year. We anticipated spending approximately $148 million this year and $141.5 next year.
Madam Chair.
Senator Amasoni.
LEAP and sleep. LEAP and sleep. They mean what?
Madam Chair, Senator Amasoni. LEAP stands for Leveraging Educational Assistance Partnership, and the S stands for State Leveraging Educational Assistance Partnership. Those are federal matching funds we received. As we distribute need-based grants to students, we are provided an allocation from the feds to match that money. In order to get the $1.3 million each year, we have to distribute approximately $120 million in need-based grants. So that would include the ACHIEVE scholarship, the Minnesota State Grant, and the other need-based programs of the office in that match.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Under the spending, the first line you see is technical changes. Each summer, we update the information we have on student aid applicants. That information can tell us a lot about who's applying for the program, how many credits they take, where they're enrolling, what their income and asset level are. So as we incorporate that new data at the end of each fiscal year, it changes our projection slightly. For this year, this biennium, that technical change added up to approximately $4.9 million. The next line you see is tuition and fee increases. When we ran the estimate at the end of session last year, we did not have the actual tuition and fee increases of each institution. So at the end of summer, we include those. We get the actual numbers as reported by each institution to the state grant manager. In fiscal year 11, we were projecting a 3% tuition and fee increase at MNSCU. In November, we changed that projection to a 5% per their direction. So that added approximately $2.8 million in estimated spending to the program. The third line under there is enrollment. Each spring and fall, we meet with institutional representatives as well as system representatives and ask them to anticipate the change in undergraduate enrollment of Minnesota residents. We use those numbers to kind of project forward how many new students will be coming into the system and possibly applying for the program. Those enrollment estimates as of last February were actually quite small compared to the number of students who actually came in. But even small growth added up to approximately $7.7 million when we saw the actual numbers come in September. And I'll talk a little more about that in a later slide. The next line you see is additional spending. In December of 2009, we compare what we projected each system, each institution type, and we compare that to the actual spending numbers that are coming in from the institution. This year, we had a gap. After accounting for income, after accounting for enrollment changes, after accounting for tuition and fee increases, program demand had increased on average approximately 8% across the board. As of this time, I can't tell you exactly where that spending is coming from. We anticipate that students are coming from families who are having those slightly lower incomes this year. And I do have another slide that elaborates on this as well.
Okay.
But the difference between the projected spending and what we actually saw in FAW this year was $13.6 million. When we project that unexplained additional spending forward, we add an additional $9.7 million onto next year's projection. Because we assume, given the state of the economy right now, that recovery is not going to be enough to offset that next year. The final line for spending estimates that we include is wage changes. In December and March of each year, we do get updated wage information from Minnesota Management and Budget. We use that wage change information and kind of apply that to our student income information to kind of anticipate how changes in wages are going to affect program demand. That added approximately $1.8 million to the bottom line for next year because we saw Minnesota wages decline in tax year 09.
So that affects whether students go to college or not, or how much they make. I'm not understanding what that means in terms of the state grant and students.
Madam Chair, it actually affects how much aid they qualify for.
Okay.
As their wages go up, they actually have a higher expected family contribution, which would result in the lower Pell Grant and lower state grant.
Okay.
When you add all these changes up, we changed the spending projection as of today to reflect $167.5 million for fiscal year 10 and $162.3 million in fiscal year 11 for a combined total of $329.9 million. Overall, that leaves us with a shortfall in this fiscal year of 23.4 and a shortfall in next fiscal year of 18.2 or 41.6 total.
Any questions? Okay, continue.
Madam Chair, the next slide that I put up is just a kind of referencing the enrollment increases we saw. When we first anticipated enrollment in the fall, as of February of last year, the systems were projecting rather mild enrollment, as seen in the first column. Minsky was anticipating a 1.6% growth in students. When we came to the actual enrollment that were reported by the systems as of November of this year, MNCU actually saw a 10% increase in their enrollment at 2 years. And this occurred at almost every type of institution. The MNCU 4 years reported were anticipating 0.4% growth. They saw 2.4% growth. The University of Minnesota was not anticipating growth. They saw 4.3% growth. The private nonprofits were actually flat across the board, and the private for-profits anticipated 8% growth and saw 17% growth in enrollments this fall. As we move into looking at next year, most of the institutions are actually anticipating rather stable enrollments. MNSCU, the two-year and four-year at 0.9 and 0.7%, the University of Minnesota at 1%, the private for-profits are anticipating a 19% growth in enrollments next year. In terms of the actual projection, the $41.6 million shortfall, when we ran the numbers in December, we anticipated that rather than leaving the enrollments flat, because that obviously hadn't happened this year, we were actually going to hedge our bets and include modest enrollment growth at all sectors. Mm-hmm. So those are the numbers you see in the column in green. 4% at MNSCU 2 years, 1% at the 4 years, 2% at the University of Minnesota, and 7.6% at the private for-profits.
Senator Lenz.
Madam Chair, Ms. Fergus, so if we look at the for-profit institutions, you're saying 2010, they're projecting a 19% increase over the 09 levels, so they gained 17% in 09, and on top of that, they're expecting almost another 20% enrollment increase?
Madam Chair, Senator Latz, correct. They are projecting those growth levels.
That's quite an explosion. To what do you attribute that?
Madam Chair and Senator, these are the actual numbers that they are seeing on their campus. They are opening more campuses. There are several institutions, such as Globe and Rasmussen, that are that have been expanding their facilities across the Twin Cities campus as well as outstate. And as they get new classrooms, they are filling them with students.
Senator Latz, Thursday is their day on the Hill for these proprietary colleges. So
we're going to be swamped.
Maybe you maybe you have some appointments with some people from your district that are coming in to talk to you about this. I know we're not having a committee hearing that day, or we'd invite them to come talk to us. Okay, any other questions? Continue.
Madam Chair, the one thing we did build into that enrollment increase assumption was the difference in spending that we're actually seeing this year. As much as we'd love for our enrollment projection or our spending projection to simply say, here's what the change in income was, here's what the change in enrollment was, and here's what we're going to spend and meet that number, we know this year we're not. And that the kind of spending we're seeing that can't be explained by enrollment, tuition, or income changes is something that we have to assume is due to the economy. And given that the economy is not really going to recover by next September, we are building in an additional spending assumption into next year's projection. What you see on the chart before you is the actual difference in spending we saw that could not be explained by enrollment, tuition, or income at each of the systems. So we saw an additional 12% increase in spending at Minsky 2 years, 6% at the 4 years, 5% at the University of Minnesota and the private nonprofits, and just under 10% at the for-profits.
I don't understand if it can't be explained by enrollment or income. It's unexplainable.
It's not really unexplainable, Madam Chair. It's more that we don't have enough information at this time to tell you point blank what it is.
Mm-hmm.
We anticipated that it's an increase in professional judgments by financial aid offices. If a student has a parent who loses the job, they can come back to the financial aid office with some documentation and say, hey, my income has changed. Can you provide me a little more aid based on my new income estimates? And they can make that adjustment. Huh. Those kind of increases.
So that's what you mean is due to the economy.
Exactly. We're probably also seeing more students enroll full-time. They, instead of taking simply three classes, they're now taking that fourth class because they have the time and the they may have lost their part-time job or they may not have as many hours at their part-time job. Mm-hmm. The other thing we're probably seeing is an increase in the number of students who file a FAFSA. Last year's sophomore in college may not have applied for aid, but as a junior, his parents told him to and he did. Those are the kind of things that we can't control for in the other assumptions that could be causing additional program spending.
Okay.
As the spring semester goes on, we'll be looking at each of those more closer and hope to have more definite answers.
Okay.
The next slide just simply walks through what the tuition and fee increases were, what we built into the system, and what we built into the end of session projection, and what we're actually seeing now. As well as the decline in average wages that we saw this year. So for tuition and fee, it's simply the change in the Minsky tuition estimates for next year that changed. For the average wage decline, as of March of last year, MMB was forecasting a change in wages for tax year 09 of plus 1%. As of December, that was negative 2%. So more students would qualify for aid on average. In terms of actual applications for aid, as of December 31st of this year, the Minnesota Office of Higher Education has seen a 10% increase in aid applications. However, students can apply for financial aid this year through the end of June or through 30 days past the start of their summer term. Approximately 65% of Minnesota undergraduates apply for financial aid every year. We are seeing more students from lower-income families enroll. We saw substantial increases in Pell Grant recipients at the public institutions, 11% at the University of Minnesota, an increase of 23% at Minsky 4 years, and 35% at Minsky 2 years.
Wow.
These are students from families with under $50,000 in income.
So we're finally being successful in attracting these low-income students to come to college. That's the good news.
Correct, Madam Chair. Moving ahead into fiscal year 2011, as we begin to address the $41.6 million shortfall, One option is that the legislature can change existing program parameters. All of the parameters listed on the table are something that would affect Minnesota state grant spending as they are adjusted. So I just wanted you to be aware of what parameters could change. And what I've listed here is the parameters as they were in fiscal year 09 and what they are in 10 and 11 in law. The other option, another option that is available in statute is that Minnesota statute allows the Minnesota Office of Higher Education to ration awards. The statute designates that we must apply a surcharge to the assigned family responsibility, as well as a percentage increase in the student's assigned student responsibility, and that these two changes must be in equal dollar amounts, and that is to cover the $41.6 million. Without parameter changes, the Office of Higher Education would ration awards. It would cause a surcharge to the AFR of 20.5%. And an increase in the assigned student responsibility of plus 2.25% or 48.25%. What would happen under this scenario is that whereas we're anticipating approximately 97,000 students getting state grant awards this year of approximately just under $1,700 each, that would drop to 87,000 students and awards of just under $1,400 per student next year. Under the governor's supplemental budget, the governor has reduced the base appropriation by $233,000 in fiscal year 10 and $2.063 million in fiscal year 11. That $2.3 million is on top of the $41.6 million shortfall in the program. So under the governor's supplemental budget, the shortfall to be, or the amount to be reduced is just over $43 million, $43.9. To meet that expectation, the governor is recommending that we eliminate the ninth semester of eligibility as well as the summer transition grant. In addition, the Office of Higher Education would ration awards to the extent that it would cover $35 million. This would add a surcharge to the AFR of 17% and increase the assigned student responsibility by 1.9%. So when you compare it to the awards that are in law for next year, we would, under the governor's recommendation, just under 85,000 students would receive an award, and the average award would be just over $1,400.
So you're really recommending, the governor's recommending sort of an across-the-board cut. So all students will take a hit, and some will lose their grants altogether, though, because they have small grants.
Madam Chair, that is correct.
Madam Chair, members, if I can maybe make 3 points about this that I think are fairly important. The first one is that the shortfall is for both fiscal 10 and 11, but we've pushed the fix into fiscal 11. Mm-hmm. And we had a conversation in the office last fall when we became aware of this, and into December and January, which we ration now this year. And our thought was is that financial aid award letters had gone out. Students were dependent on those grant monies to finish their school year out. Probably too hard at that point to make adjustments. So we thought, we'll push everything into fiscal 11. By doing that, then parents and families know, and students know sooner what they have to face and can make adjustments in their choices about higher education.
But now the average award cut will be $200. $300 or something for next year.
Correct, Madam Chair, 250.
And if you'd done it this year, it would have been half that then.
Madam Chair, I'm trying to think of the how it splits between the fiscal years. I'm not quite sure it'd be half, but like, you could think about it that way.
I don't know if I would have made the same decision. You could have adjusted for the second semester, right, instead of just the first semester.
Madam Chair, absolutely.
The award letters go out for the whole year, though, not just for the semester.
Yes. I'm not sure that's true. And that's why we did the summer grant reduction, is because those awards had not gone out yet. Those letters had not gone out. So it was kind of a question of, we've made a promise, you keep the promise.
Madam Chair, if I may, when you ration the awards, the average award does go down by that approximately $250 to $300. However, given that it's a surcharge on the assigned family responsibility and the assigned student responsibility, For a family that has a $1,000 parental contribution, a 20% surcharge means that family pays an additional $200 in tuition. At the $5,000 level, which some of our families do have, that means they pay an extra $1,000 in tuition. Those are the magnitude of changes that we were trying to avoid.
Madam Chair, members, again, and perhaps the second point is, we talked about earlier, we want to make sure that if recommendations to you are of a permanent nature, that, I mean, if the issue is being addressed is of a permanent nature, we make a permanent recommendation, mm-hmm. if you will. And if it's only one time, that would be structured that way. In other words, while we've kind of combined the fix, if you will, into fiscal 11, the problem for fiscal 10, it only has to be dealt with once. We don't have to carry that forward on a permanent basis into fiscal 12, fiscal 13, and thereafter. So we've tried to be very careful about what needs to be of a permanent nature in order to meet the resources and what needs to be one time.
So the proration is permanent?
No, Madam Chair, because it's statutory, that's the point, is that would apply just to fiscal 11.
Say it again?
It would only apply to next fiscal year, to fiscal year 11.
And then it would be next year that we would have to adjust for 12 and 13 based on what the forecast is, et cetera, et cetera.
I'm sure that's
we wouldn't
that's
have to do that this year.
That's true. And we're trying to avoid an issue that occurred the last time we went through all of this in 02 and 03. Mm-hmm. Permanent changes were made to the program. And I'm not sure if you were the chair at that time, Madam Chair. And if you recall, there was a large, very material cancellation back to the general fund because of the permanent changes in 05 that, had we done it this way, would not have occurred.
Okay. Anybody else have a comment? I guess I spoke to Mr. Metzen and Mr. Misakonis just briefly before the committee meeting because I knew that the recommendation was going to be to eliminate the summer transition grant. And this is kind of I argued that this is an across-the-board cut and that maybe we need to be a little bit more selective, a little bit more surgical. I mean, I know that program hasn't gone into it'll just start this summer, but the whole idea was that we have these students who are first-generation students graduating from high school not having taken the rigorous courses that they should have to prepare them. Now, we hopefully that with the standards, that's going to start changing. And we saw that great presentation about career planning and college planning a couple weeks ago with the Navient system or whatever system. So that students start in eighth and ninth grade thinking, well, this is the profession I want. These are the courses I have to take. I want to go to college. Therefore, I have to take AP science and AP math, and I have to take more rigorous courses. So perhaps a summer academy won't be necessary down the road. But I don't think we're seeing that happening yet. And my concern is that we have never quite solved this problem of remedial courses in college. And we're still seeing too many students who are, you know, graduate with decent grades in high school still not doing well in the ACCUPLACER and ending up taking remedial courses. And that costs the system, the college systems, a lot. So students are staying in college longer then because they're not accumulating credits. So that was really the rationale behind doing the summer academy. And I'm kind of disappointed that the recommendation is to discontinue it even before it started. Because I think even in tough economic times, even more so in tough economic times, we have to figure out what's the best way to spend our dollars that can be the most effective. And this seemed like a very targeted approach to getting students who come to college academically unprepared in an intensive way to get them prepared for college so they can go through more quickly and graduate. So you told me your rationale was just the newbies go. And I'm saying that I think that sometimes the new things that we want to happen are maybe better to do those than the old things. And I understand that the old things are basically work, study, and childcare, and those are still good things, or just straight money to the students. There's no bad things that we do in our division or wasteful spending that we do. Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, I completely agree with your analysis, and I wonder if the Office of Higher Education has made any projections of what those additional costs would be by skipping this program and
and forcing the students into remedial courses and perhaps having to stay 10 semesters instead of 8 semesters to get their degrees.
And if we eliminate the 9th semester as well, then they're not really getting any financial aid at the end. They're on their own, really.
I mean, are there any projections as to what the additional system costs will be in year 5 or 6 because of this change now? Or even perhaps more catastrophically, if they get to the end of their grant program eligibility and they can't afford to go back and finish that last semester or two for their degree, have we made an even larger investment without getting the return on the investment, you know, at all, or delay it until some number of years down the road when they can afford to go back?
And actually, this is an area in which we fall short in the Midwest in degree completion, is that we are good at getting kids into college, but we're not so good at getting them through college. And it's one thing that's coming up that we should maybe have them come in and do a presentation, that the Midwest Higher Education Compact has gotten a Lumina grant to do a degree bank where students can put their credits in, not a degree bank, a credit bank. They put their credits into the pot, and then colleges can compete to say, okay, you need a year, you need a year and a half, you can come, we'll help you online, whatever, complete your degree. And so it is a way to help us bring those partial degree candidates to completion. It's what we need to do. And response.
Madam Chair and Senator Latz, no, we have not done any kind of analysis of the sort that you indicated. It's a bit hard to evaluate a program before it started. There is some irony in this. As we sit here before you, there are people back in our offices reviewing 20 applications with the group for this very program. So the process must go on until, you know, permanent changes are made and decisions.
Right. So we have colleges in the queue that are gearing up to offer these programs.
Manchin, we are of the belief that we think some colleges are going to offer them anyway because they are important.
And I think some have. You know, I think Century does, for one. Senator Roebling.
Madam Chair and Mr. Kanas, I'm wondering if what is the cost per pupil to take a summer readiness course or kind of remedial course like the Summer Academy in comparison to what the state would be paying if they took the remedial course during the regular school year?
Madam Chair and Senator Roebling, the summer transition grant does provide for slightly larger financial aid awards for students in that program as compared to the general state grant. It was anticipated that these are the lowest income students, and to get that remedial coursework, they would need that additional grant responsibility. But as far as the actual dollar amounts, I don't have those with me today.
Well, isn't the idea that it gives them, in a sense, an extra semester of state grant money, and instead of taking that starting in the fall, they just start in the summer, and they get an extra semester.
Madam Chair, it sounds like it's a little extra more than what
only because they're low income. They're lower income, so they get more money. I think that's what Ms. Fergus said.
Madam Chair, if I may, we also adjusted the state grant formula for those students so that they do get some additional grant aid on top. Or their grants are larger than the average state grant for that student at a similar income. But it's specifically for that program.
That wasn't in our legislation. They did that on their own.
Okay. I just want to make sure I understand. So if that student were to take that course for a regular semester, the state grant would actually be a little less than if they took it, the same student, the same low-income student. Would the grant be a little less for the semester remedial course than for the summer academy?
Madam Chair, I believe so, yes. It really would depend on the remedial course they're taking. If it's in combination with their degree program. The summer transition grant program, however, essentially takes the state grant formula and then adjusts what the parent contribution is, given that a lot of these low-income students can't afford that parental contribution in the summer. I hope I answered your question.
I think I understand. But actually, then the state is making a little bigger contribution for the Summer Academy program than they would if they took it during the regular school year. But we also then are, we aren't requiring the student to use up their semester credits, their eight or nine semester credits, whatever they're going to end up with, or semesters worth of financial aid. Because they still, that doesn't count against, or does it count against their financial aid? Are they still eligible for nine semesters worth of financial aid?
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, the summer bridge program does count as their first semester of state grant receipt, yes. So it is part of their eligibility.
Okay.
I think the idea, though, it's a little more intensive with a little with more support services than if they were just taking regular remedial courses.
Mm-hmm. And Madam Chair and Senator Roebling, on the difference in funding, most of these students are not taking a full-time course load in the summer. They might be picking up one remedial class, or they might be picking up three remedial classes. So when you actually talk about the difference in funding, it becomes much smaller when you look at it on the per course level.
So it's prorated based on the number of courses.
Correct, Madam Chair.
Okay, any other questions about the state grant recommendations?
Right. Madam
Chair. To achieve? Oh, Senator Wieger.
It's okay just to kind of step back. And first, there's a meeting in about an hour at the Department of Ed. I'll be there talking about remedial programs, testing, college readiness, career readiness, et cetera, something you're working on and others. But it got me thinking, we have these silos, and I don't say that pejoratively, but you know, different departments, and you know, what, and then with the emergence, 150 plus legislators involved in early childhood, the recognition of P20, you know, as a system, and think about it, why not, you know, Department of Education, P20, and workforce training, and you figure it out with minimizing the impact on some of these cuts that we're looking at for students. I don't administratively quite know how it all works out, but you know, Mr. Metzen is a former superintendent, and you certainly have had to think of those types of possibilities, and then the tie-in with workforce training as well. There's lots of discussion about the urge to merge. You want to make sure it's correct, but I've seen bipartisan discussion, but haven't seen any in this area, but I think it is very amenable to not only further study, but to actually do it. So maybe it's more rhetorical, but wanted to get that out.
Mr. Metzen, did you want to comment?
No. thank you, Senator Pappas, Senator Wieger. There's no question, as we look at the budget today, we have some huge problems. But I would maintain that we're going to have to really be creative. We're going to have to be so cooperative. And Senator Latz mentioned the career schools, the for-profits. I've studied those, and I'm a public school person. But I think as a system, whether it's K-12, early childhood, higher ed, we've got to figure out ways to work together that's very, very creative. I'm very impressed for the for-profit, and I've looked at their model relative to remedial, and I've suggested to Chancellor McCormick and President Brunix, we can learn together on how to do things. And I think our focus should only be what's best for kids and families and get that right. And I think we have to look at a more creative approach to secondary options. I think there are more ways that we could look at technical colleges and how to meet the needs of students and parents. So I couldn't agree with you more. I think anyone thinks that in the next 2 or 3 years this economy is going to flip around and we're going to have all kinds of money to spend, I think they're sadly mistaken. I think the future is going to belong to those countries and states that figure out how to work together, to be cooperative, and always just saying what's best for students. And I think you're right on. I think the P20 is a great example. The compact that we're involved with, the credit sharing that you mentioned, I think is just super ideas. And partnerships are a lot of work, but they're the way to go. And the cooperative working relationships, and I've said publicly a number of times, there's going to be a huge changes in we've already seen the for-profit, the leadership, the private leadership. You have President Brunich, you have Chancellor McCormick, as we look at all of these systems, I think, not to get ahead of ourselves, but we're going to need, including the legislators, for people that believe in partnerships and working together and how to do things in a cooperative manner and to take best practices and things that are really working. And so that was a long answer to a short question, a rhetorical question, but it gave me an opportunity to think that we really have to start blending this together and really set aside some of our traditional biases to make the system work for families.
Senator Letts.
Madam Chair, I guess to amplify on that, I can't help but note the irony of the explosion in the demand for higher education and the governor's further cuts to the higher education system. And clearly part of the strategy here is to allow the private for-profits to fill the gap. But even that has a budget impact because of the financial aid implications. You know, at some point, MNSCU is going to be unable to accommodate the increases in demand, or they will do so only by compromising the quality of the education that's delivered. You know, once you fill up a classroom, I guess, and you've got limited space. But I don't know that we want to create or go down the road of relying on a system that becomes more and more dependent on the for-profit privates, because it's, generally speaking, more expensive for the kids to be educated or people to be educated in those institutions.
In addition, students are taking more classes online when they can't get into a course. I was just told at Metro State they're up to 25% online now. And that's really a reaction to not being able to get into classes.
Yeah, I'm sure those classes fill the quickest.
My class.
Yeah, okay. and they're more expensive.
Before you go on to the Achieve, I did have a couple people who asked to testify on the state grant, and that is Tyler Smith and Jennifer Weil from MSCSA, President and State Chair. I did forget to ask if anyone wanted to testify on the governor's budget proposal, but we will do that at the end of the meeting. Welcome to the Higher Ed Committee.
Thanks, Madam Chair and members. My name is Tyler Smith with the Minnesota State College Student Association. There's a couple things I wanted to say to you today about the financial aid and state grant shortfalls that we have in front of us. We know that there's a lot of significant challenges ahead for this committee in dealing with these massive shortfalls projected with the state grant program. And we've seen that the governor proposes reductions to a number of financial aid programs, including the state grant program, that are somewhat troubling considering the massive increases in demand for these programs. The massive shortfall in the state grant program will lead to significant numbers of students at community and technical colleges losing eligibility for state grants. One of the rationing scenarios that's the OHE is having to look at shows that surcharges are placed on the assigned family responsibility and the student share. And under these scenarios, over 7,000 students at MNSCU two-year institutions would lose state grant dollars. This significant number of students that we worry will affect a lot of them and their ability to obtain a higher education as we move forward. And we're hoping that any solution to this shortfall, as we look at the state grant formula, would not affect the LME that was approved last session. We're looking to protect the value of the LME and the state grant formula just because as we've looked at this formula as a whole before, it seems to fit the best and to affect students kind of on a broad reach of the formula rather than any specific group of students taking the brunt of a cut to the state grant formula. Living costs for students in relation to the LME continue to run well above the $7,000 allowance currently in law. And the truth of the matter is the LME is simply just a large part of the formula that we can't afford to lose. If the LME is reduced back to its previous level of $6,200, it would be a huge step back in fixing one of the major challenges in the program. So I'd hope that as we move forward, we don't like to see reductions in the state grant program. If that were to happen, we'd like to see it not occur to the LME.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Jennifer Weil, and I'm the state chair of the Minnesota State University Student Association. Thank you for the opportunity to have us address you today. I echo some of the sentiments of the president from CSA. You know, we understand the difficult decisions that this committee is going to have to make in the foreseeable future, and we do not envy you. It's going to be a very difficult process, but we do appreciate the opportunity to be part of it. To sort of address the same points for the state legislative mandated solution that the Office of Higher Education presented within the university student system within MNSCU, about 620 of our students will no longer be eligible for the state grant. And for those students that who would be eligible, they'll see about a reduction of about $486 per award. And as far as the living and miscellany expenses, this committee, as well as the Office of Higher Education, has really identify the fact that that $7,000 of living and miscellaneous expenses does not cover the entire cost of non-tuition and fee expenses. It's usually projected to be around $10,000. So that increase still does not completely cover the whole cost of living and miscellaneous expenses, and that's why it is something that's very important to the students. Also, that increase affects is need-based, based on financial need, and so it's the fairest place to be able to put more supported funding for our students because it is based on financial need. With that, I guess we would yield for questions.
Questions from anybody on the committee?
Okay.
Senator Robley.
I'm wondering that, you know, juggling the living and miscellaneous expenses and the straight tuition aid, do students find it easier to borrow for the straight tuition, I mean the actual cost of tuition at their colleges and universities, than putting, or do the banks recognize the package?
Ms. Weil?
Madam Chair, Senator, I know that at least from speaking from my own personal experience, I'm also a non-traditional student, so I have children and childcare expenses as well. And when I've applied for state or for federal federal grant funding, as well as for my own private loans, that was part of it. They take part of that into account.
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling.
Mr. Smith.
In my experience with students who use the state grant, a lot of times students don't necessarily understand the formula that's behind the state grant that they receive funding for. And when a student receives a state grant, the first things they're going to fund is their tuition and their books and such. And oftentimes the grants that they're receiving aren't going to completely cover that anyways. And so in those circumstances, the amount that's allocated for the living and miscellaneous expenses aren't actually going to the living expenses. It's just part of the formula that allocates the money there, if that makes any sense.
Right. But, Madam Chair, so after you've already applied all of that state and federal grant money and you need to borrow some more money and you go to a lender to borrow, if they think your tuition is already covered, will they still borrow you money for other expenses? For the living expenses.
Madam Chair, Senator, yes.
Ms. Weil.
They will.
Okay.
All right, thank you both very much. Okay, let's bring the office back up to talk about the Achieve Scholarship. Is there anyone else that wanted to testify on the state grant?
Madam Chair and members, now we'll move to the Achieve Scholarship part of our presentation. And with us now is Megan Fitzgibbon, who is a manager of that program. Again, we've tried to structure this presentation in a broad sense to give you some background for members that aren't as quite as familiar with the details, to describe what happened last session and to let you know what happened throughout the course of the last 6 months, and address all the points of issue with this program.
Madam Chair, members, just for the record, my name is Megan Fitzgibbon. I am the manager of scholarship programs at the office and am the manager of the Achieve Scholarship. And like Mark said, I'm going to kind of do a background of where Achieve came from and how it's evolved over the last couple of years. The original Achieve Scholarship was passed into the 2007 legislative session. In that, the appropriation for the biennium was a total of $10.8 million. In the first year, there were no awards to students. The first year, there was $3 million allocated for grants to high schools to help promote rigorous course taking, and that was managed by our office as well. In addition, there was $200,000 to Minscu and $200,000 to the University of Minnesota each year to provide additional post-secondary enrollment options or PSEO options to high schools around the state. That was both trying to offer additional college in the schools opportunities and just PSEO in general.
Ms. Fitzgibbon, can you give us an idea of the rigorous course-taking grants, like what, you know, what some high schools did with that?
The rigorous in terms of the grants, there was a report on that, right? Madam Chair, I believe there was a report that our office, I didn't manage those grants. That was managed by another person in our office who does the ICAP as well. But right. My understanding was most of it was similar to the stuff that happens in ICAP. That was more for counseling to encourage students to take the right courses along those lines. Mm-hmm. The second year of the biennium, fiscal year 09, was the first year that there were scholarships actually awarded to students. And at that time, the ongoing base funding was to be $10 million in each year of the biennium. The original program, which, like I said before, was enacted and went in place in fiscal year 09, the requirements were that students had to have graduated after January 1st of 08 and completed each of the required courses in one of the four programs, rigorous programs, with a C or above. They had to have a parental adjusted gross income of less than $75,000, and we do put in parentheses if there is an independent student, that same income requirement applies for student or spouse together. The award was a one-time award of $1,200, and students had up to 4 years immediately following high school graduation to use the scholarship, apply for, and use it. And they only had to be enrolled for 3 credits in each term to receive the $600 each semester, or total of
$1,200. That's
all. At the beginning of the program, at the request of many institutions, and we looked at how the application process, how the awards are going to be sent out to students. A centralized process, meaning the awarding and eligibility determination, was determined to be the best option at the office. And that means that the office, myself and my staff, are responsible for evaluating transcripts that come in from students and determining eligibility and sending the money out to schools.
Madam Chair, if I can add, this is a very labor-intensive practice. Staff essentially went through transcript by transcript, class by class, to make sure that they were all at least a C.
In that first year, the fiscal year 09, the spending is listed here in the chart. Approximately $2.12 million was dispersed to a little under 2,000 eligible students, and that was a little over $2 million of our total $7 million available in the appropriation for the year, and that meant that approximately $5 million was returned to the general fund from fiscal year 09 for the Achieve Scholarship. You can see the breakdown by sector as well as the total here in the chart as well.
And Madam Chair, members, if you recall the conversation last spring, we knew that we weren't going to spend the money, and I think we did everything that we could physically possible to get the word out to students and the financial aid directors that this money was available for students. And unfortunately, we were not successful since $5 million did cancel back.
And that was the end of the biennium, so there was, yeah.
Going into the 2009 legislative session, the Achieve Scholarship was changed significantly. The maximum award and the award calculation was changed, which meant that the maximum award changed from $1,200 to a little over $4,000 a year. The income eligibility changed in that instead of it being an adjusted gross income cutoff, a student had to qualify for either Pell or state grant or both in many cases in order to qualify for the Achieve Scholarship. The academic requirements are also modified to that the student had to complete the rigorous program with an unweighted GPA of 2.5 or higher. This is in comparison to the original program where a student had to have a C or above in each course of the rigorous program. which meant that a single grade of less than C no longer prevented a student from getting the scholarship. We did see many students who had applied with transcripts that they got a D in their first trimester of their math in freshman year, and that meant they did not get the Achieve scholarship, even though they might have graduated with a 3.0 GPA. In addition, this academic change made it easier and streamlined the transcript evaluation because we no longer had to look at each course for the grade. We could just make sure that they completed it and then look at the overall GPA. The eligibility period also changed. The original program, students had up to 4 years to apply for and use the scholarship. Students needed to enroll immediately after high school and could only use it in that first year immediately following high school graduation. And in addition, they had to enroll full time. So the enrollment requirement went from 3 credits a semester to 15 credits a semester or term. In the 2009 legislative session, this program, obviously looking at the appropriation, it was originally $10 million ongoing. It went to 4.35 in each year of the biennium, and the ongoing base funding was the same amount for 12-13. The appropriation was based on growth projections that the office used. Many of them were the same growth projections that we use for state grant. But we also talked about and used the program changes that obviously went into effect, enrollment projections, and economic factors that we knew in May of 2009 when looking at this appropriation. We, in May and ongoing in June, we continued to, in the office, use a centralized process where the office was reviewing transcripts and determining eligibility for students, but we did think about and discuss a decentralized process as a future option with institutions in June of 2009. This is where the schools would tell us who was eligible and we would send the money rather than all of the transcript evaluation happening at the office. Since spring is not over with yet, we have fall 2009 spending listed here in the chart, but you can see that compared to the 4.35 that was available in our appropriation, in the fall term, approximately November, the middle of November, end of November, we started to get these numbers in from schools and started to see the money going out to schools. And in fall, approximately $4.32 million was dispersed to a little over or almost 3,200 eligible 2009 high school graduates in just for the fall term. And this is in comparison to the 1,750 students we had projected in May of 2009. So it's, you know, over almost double. One thing to remember also is that students who graduated in 2008 are still eligible for deferral payments. They have up to 4 years, so until 2012, to receive their scholarships. So just in the fall, we saw a little over 300,000 dispersed in deferral payments to 514 or a little over 500 eligible 2008 graduates. Got a similar chart for fiscal year 10 as we did for fiscal year 9, just for fall, showing the breakdown by sector as well and the percentages of the total received for this fall semester.
That's what the chart is, just the fall?
Just fall.
Would you go back?
Sure, Madam Chair.
Would you go back?
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
So that means you basically used up your entire appropriation for the year in just the fall semester.
Essentially, yes, Madam Chair, Senator Roebling. And we're going to talk, I have another slide that talks a little bit more about that as well.
Senator Sharon.
In this next slide, are you going to be talking about what you think has made that change? What of the changes that we made or what are the factors that created this change?
Mm-hmm.
And also, I noticed that the U of M and the private institutions carry a substantially high portion of this. Are you going to discuss what might have driven that as well?
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, yes. So the next couple slides cover that.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the reasons, as I said, Senator Sharon, that we saw this increase, as you noted, at the University of Minnesota was in July, We were approached by the University of Minnesota, and we discussed in the office about doing a pilot application process or an electronic application process on a pilot basis with the University of Minnesota. The University of Minnesota requested to provide electronic application files to us with all of the application information for their potentially eligible students who had applied for financial aid at the University of Minnesota. In addition, the Twin Cities campus agreed to review the transcripts and provide electronic data with the academic eligibility with these students. After discussing this, we concluded that both the FAFSA and the University of Minnesota's financial aid notification met the statutory definition of student application for the Achieve Scholarship, and we looked at this as a way to eliminate most of the paperwork obligations for students and parents at the U, and also as a pilot to test the capabilities of our new database that we were establishing at the office, and in hopes that at some point in the future it could be expanded to all institutions. However, we did not anticipate or project the size of the increase in qualifying students for the Achieve Scholarship, and so that's one of the reasons why you can see such a high increase in the number of students at the U and the overall spending of the program.
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
The university, of course, has high admission standards, and also the private schools do, too, I guess. So I would assume that almost every one of them who qualified for the Pell or state grant program and who had been accepted had a 2.5 GPA. Would you say that would be correct?
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, yes, that would be correct. There would be a high percentage of them would meet the requirements for the Achieve Scholarship. However, one of the things that I think we didn't expect is the number of students that would be enrolled for 15 credits. At full time,
Madam Chair,
Senator Roebling,
and I imagine this is quite a bonus for the U of M because don't they have the Founder Scholarship, which guarantees free tuition for eligible students? I think who are Pell eligible. So now instead of their scholarship fund covering it, all of a sudden they got $4,100 extra from the Achieve program to help make that free. Tuition possible. Would that be right?
Ms. Fitzgibbon.
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, the answer is some of the students that received Achieve would have most likely received Founders for a portion of it. One thing to remember is that the Founders Scholarship only covers the tuition and fees. Many of the students who were, especially the students who were getting the over $4,000 grants, they already had Pell and State at their maximum amounts, at a combined amount. So the amount of Founders that they would have received would have been small, minimal, if any. As they go up the income scale, the Achieve Scholarship goes down. Their state and Pell grants go down. And so there's definitely a gap there that there's students that would have possibly received Founders. And instead, it was supplemented with part of the Achieve Scholarship that they received. But most of the students, the Achieve Scholarship was going over and above their tuition and fees.
I see that Mr. Fitzenreiter's in the audience, and maybe we could ask him to comment in a little while or ask him some questions about the university students. And the requirement, I thought the university had a requirement, now you had to take 15 credits, so you should check on that, ask on that, because then they definitely would have qualified. That could have been one of the miscalculations. Like you said, so many students taking 15 credits. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Senator Sharon.
Did I understand that the pilot project was an invitation from the Department of Higher Education to have this experiment that is only with the University of Minnesota to enter the U of M? The U of M requested to provide electronic data files. So the continuation of that. Creates a situation in which the probability, first of all, much of the money is expended now. So anyone that's not involved in that or doesn't have that advantage that the other systems not only doesn't have the advantage of the process, but also doesn't have any resources available to them. Do I correctly understand that?
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, I'm going to cover a little bit of that in another slide, but it was a pilot project, so it's not something that at this point we are for sure planning on ongoing for the next, you know, year or for the future. However, I think it's something that we may we would open up to all institutions. It was just a pilot project for 1 year to see if our capabilities could handle the information from the U.
Madam
Chair and members, if I could speak to this. This is actually a very important point because, you know, we keep saying around the office, we did this, but it was the right thing to do. We should make it easier for eligible students to apply for financial aid. We've been hearing for quite a bit in the other body more than I think here in the Senate, but get these kids to file these FAFSAs so they show up and they qualify. So given the context of that and the environment, we thought this was the right decision. Moreover, you know, if you, you may be aware or not, the federal government is changing, or I'm sorry, is talking very about changing the FAFSA filing very significantly. They want to simplify it quite a bit. They're making linkages back to income tax system. And it's my belief that we can learn from this process because if that's the case and if we have a lot more students filing FAFSAs, the ACHIEVE is not the problem. The state grant will be the problem because we're going to have a lot more demand for that program simply because it's easier to file. But again, as we assert, that's the right thing to do for the program. And it's something we're going to have to bring to you as we try to understand it. You know, if they, if this automatic filing or the ease of filing creates a demand for the program of this size, what does it mean for the state grant?
I mean, we are a victim of our success. If we didn't have a deficit, we would be jumping up and down with joy that we're getting so many kids going to college. Sarah Sharon.
Yeah, certainly the issue isn't access or our discouragement of anybody applying and getting taking advantage of these resources for the purposes for which we have. It has more to do with the authorization of a program that gave that gladly uses the resources, but the distribution of them. And that's my concern when I saw that graph that something's in place that created a disproportionate, I think, share of those dollars going to the University of Minnesota. And you haven't talked about the privates, why, what your explanation is for why that might be going there. But the money's now not there for those who weren't allowed to participate in a pilot project that I would think that in authorizing it, you might consider the possibility that it would have created this inequity.
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
Well, you know, the first year of the ACHIEVE program, the private schools did fairly well, or the students from their schools did fairly well. And the explanation I received on that was their admissions counselors and their financial aid counselors really, really work hard to put together packages and find any resource they can to try and make their schools as affordable to those students as they possibly can be. So they're looking under every rock for resources, and they pull all of these things together and help the students find them and encourage them to apply for them. I don't know if that happened as much in the first year in our public institutions, but I did hear that the private school financial aid counselors were well aware of it and were encouraging students to apply. And it was disappointing that more didn't, because the first year we had $5 million extra.
Went back into the general fund.
You can use that money now.
Mm-hmm.
Ms. Fitzgibbon.
Oh, Madam Chair, thanks. In addition to the pilot project, there were other reasons why I think we saw additional spending in the ACHIEVE. Many of them were the same reasons that we saw additional spending in the state grant, or were projecting additional spending in the state grant. And by October, we knew that the new projections were indicating that the ACHIEVE scholarship was going to spend $10 million in this year if all of the promised awards were paid to students for the upcoming winter and spring terms. And like I said, the pilot application process was part of that, but we also saw, as Senator Roebling mentioned, increased promotion of the program at all levels. Both the university, MinSCU, 2 years, 4 years, they were really pushing ACHIEVE, as well as high schools in our office, and were really pushing the ACHIEVE scholarship because it had been around for a year and they knew about it. And the $4,000 was a big number. In addition, just like the state grant, we saw an increase in financial aid applications, a significant increase in the number of eligible students with incomes of less than $45,000, and the higher than projected enrollment and tuition increases. Those all played a part in the increased spending projections for the Achieve Scholarship. In October, November, with approval from Minnesota Management and Budget, the office utilized the state grant transfer authority to fulfill the promises that had already been made to students for the spring semester. The reasoning behind this was the carryback authority is not available in the Achieve Scholarship, so even though there was an appropriation for the Achieve Scholarship in fiscal year 11, there was no authority for the office to use that funding in fiscal year 10. This transfer is intended to be temporary, and the funds will be returned to the state grant in fiscal year 11. In addition, at that time, we stopped accepting new applications on December 1st, and students who had applied after the fall deadline, which is the same as the state grant deadline, 30 days into their fall semester, who could have been eligible for a spring award only, were notified that they would not be receiving awards in December at this time.
Madam Chair, before we pass on this, this again was a struggle last fall. We've been accused of overspending this program, and I'm going to state that that simply is not true. Certainly, awards were made, but we cannot overspend the program. The department will not let us cut checks to institutions. That's not really the issue. The issue is, how do you deal with an oversubscribed program? Do you create a waiting list? Well, we don't have the authority to do that in law. Do you prorate? Well, we don't have the authority to do that in law. So we were struggling with what do we do in order to deal with this problem, given all the reasons that Ms. Fitzgibbon mentioned it occurred. So again, with conversations with the governor's office and the department, we said, well, promises have been made, and we will transfer money between fiscal years and between programs in order to make sure that they continue to be met for this year, which is what I, again, going back to the state grant program, students made choices based on what they thought they were going to receive in financial aid, and we thought we owed it to them to maintain that. Earlier, Ms. Fergus talked about the sleep and leap money. We talked to the federal government. They said that this was allowable spending for on this program as opposed to the state grant, so we moved that money here again to deal with that issue. This leaves $1.3 million in sleep leap money for next year, only for the Achieve program. To the extent that the money is transferred back to the state grant program, there's no money left in this program in the general fund. So we're going to come to you with some recommendations on how to deal with that. However, it is ongoing in the base, $4.35 million. So I think it's a question of how you deal with this in the short term and how you deal with the larger set of problems that we're kind of bringing to you today to discuss.
Madam Chair, members, so as Mark mentioned, we do have some recommendations in the governor's supplemental budget and from the governor's office about what to do ongoing with Achieve. And the recommendations now include a prioritized award process. This means that all of the qualifying applicants that have completed a complete application on file that in our office as of the priority award date would be eligible for an award. And we define the complete application as one that has the student application as well as the transcript or documentation that goes along with the academic requirements. And we've set a priority award date of August 31st. The recommendations also include the authorization to ration awards. So as of August 31st, we would see how many students we had who were eligible with complete applications. And we would determine at that point if, based on what the award calculation is in law, if the appropriation was insufficient, the awards would be reduced using similar rationing to state grant, because the Achieve Scholarship is set up very similar to state grant. And in addition, we would clarify the language or the process for electronic application data transfers in expectation that in the future it might be a possibility where we would exchange data, application data from institutions.
So for next year, we only have 1.2 for the scholarship. And then the following year, if we don't cut it in the out years, we have a base of how much?
4.35, Madam Chair.
4.35 for the biennium?
No, each year of the biennium.
Each year.
So 8.7.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Sam Roebling.
But won't the demand really grow? Because didn't we make them eligible for up to 4 years? So we'll not only have the ones who applied this year and were successful, assuming that they stay in college and are still income eligible, but we could have a whole new batch of recent high school graduates who would also potentially be applying.
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, that was one of the changes. So we would, the first program, students have until 2012 to get their $1,200. Now we only have one class every year that's getting the Achieve Scholarship. So next year it will be only students who graduated or will graduate in 2010, because they must use the scholarship within the first year immediately following their high school graduation.
Senator Roebling, I had proposed having it for 4 years.
That's what I'm remembering.
Thank goodness we didn't do that.
Yeah.
Even though it was a great idea, and I think I had a higher limit, too, I wanted.
Mm-hmm.
But you're right. There was just so many more students out there eligible than any of us realized.
With that, Madam Chair, I guess
that
ends our presentation.
Okay. Okay. Anybody else have any questions on this or anything, the governor's budget proposal or state grant or anything? Okay. Is there anyone from the audience who wants to testify on anything you've heard today? Comment? Yes, Mr. Stanton.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Russ Stanton, Director of Government Relations for the State University faculty, the interfaculty organization. Just like to testify very briefly on the governor's proposed budget. First of all, to say that we were very, very thankful for the federal stimulus money, which came with a maintenance of efforts requirement that limited the cuts to $47 million to the U of M and Minsky. I'm sure we would have been suffering much greater cuts, we know it's never fun to take cuts, but we probably got off a little easy compared to local government aides and state agencies and so forth because of that requirement.
This year,
correct. I would like to say, and this is going to surprise many of you, that we are supportive of the way the governor allocated the cuts between the U of M and Minsky. I don't think you've heard me say that too many times, but we do think that's fair to bring both systems back to their 2006 base. And we don't want you to think that Minsky is getting off real easy because they're taking a $10 million base. We'd like to point out that since fiscal year 2006, the enrollment at Minsky has grown about 17,500 students. And so they're going to be educating 17,500 more students than in 2006 with 2006 dollars. So it is going to be a very painful cut, and we'd want you to take that into consideration when you're doing the allocation. So that's all I have to say. Thank you.
I forgot, Mr. Fitzenrider, did anybody have any other questions about the Achieve and the University of Minnesota that you wanted to ask him?
Well, Madam Chair, I don't know if he wants to answer my question about how it impacted their Founders Scholarship Fund.
Yes. Can you talk to us about, thank you, I knew there was a question. Oh, all right.
Phone a friend.
Peter, okay.
I could help with the transition there, Senator Pappas. Senator Roebling, you teed it up very well as soon as we saw how much the university got out of the Achieve. We strategically decided that let's go approach the university that maybe we could get a million or two back. And Mr. Fitzenreiter was very quick to say no way, but I just want you to know that we made the approach, and we're willing to ask again if you'd like. So you picked up on it very quickly, and so did we, and we thought maybe the university would like to send us some of that founders scholarship money, but I don't think the check's in the mail yet, but we're still hopeful.
Madam Chair, my name is Peter Zetterberg. I work for the University of Minnesota. And it is indeed the case that nearly all of the $2.3 million in Achieve scholarship dollars our students received this fall did help us meet the promised free tuition guarantee. Picking up on some of the other comments, it is also always going to be the case that nearly all of our Pell or state grant eligible freshmen in the future will qualify for Achieve scholarships, because basically that's what our admission standards are, and nearly all of our freshmen do take 15 credits. Achieve is a program that by its design will always favor students in four-year institutions, and probably especially students in private colleges and at the University of Minnesota.
So, Mr. Zetterberg, though I think what our intention was that we wanted the Achieve Scholarship to be kind of the last dollar in. So are you saying that it ended up substituting for the Founders Scholarship? Because the Founders Scholarship only covers tuition and fees, whereas the Achieve Scholarship can cover cost of attendance.
Madam Chair, the Founders Scholarship is or what we now call the Promise Free Tuition Program is actually not a scholarship. It's a commitment that students from Minnesota who are Pell eligible mm-hmm. will receive a package of federal grants, state grants, and university scholarships that fully covers tuition and required fees. So in meeting that commitment from day one, we have always counted all federal grants. We have always counted all state grants, including Achieve. And then we use our own scholarship dollars to fill any of the remaining gap.
So your last dollar in, and Achieve is supposed to be the last dollar in. You're supposed to cover the tuition, and then the Achieve scholarship is supposed to be for cost of attendance. So how did that get turned around?
Madam Chair, that was never my understanding of what the Achieve program was.
Well, when the Achieve program is supposed to be the last dollar after all other scholarships and awards are counted, that was the intention.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry. All I can say is that that was never my understanding.
Ms. Fergus.
Madam Chair, working through the legislative language last session for the Achieve Scholarship Program, it was your intent that the Achieve Scholarship be the last dollar in. However, from an administrative standpoint, that's not always possible, given that student packages vary widely. Given the in discussions with your office, we actually worked out a compromise that would allow Achieve to cover that cost of attendance for students who their Pell State and Achieve Scholars go beyond the tuition level at the University of Minnesota, but there really wasn't any way for us to control that whether or not the Achieve was the last dollar in.
And Madam Chair, we do indeed have many students who receive the free tuition commitment whose total grant and scholarship award is way above that. I didn't mean to imply that it's always capped at just that lower amount. But in terms of packaging, and in terms of meeting that commitment, especially for the higher income, low income students who still qualify, not the zero EFC, but the higher ones, we certainly do count everything, and then we fill whatever remaining gap remains between the tuition and required fee amount.
So in terms of how much money you raised for the Founders Scholarship, did you actually saw a less of a need to have to raise those dollars during this Achieve year?
In this current year, that was the case. Next year, because of what will probably happen.
Hey, you're going to have to make up for it then.
Big time.
Right.
That's correct.
Okay.
But that's our commitment.
Okay. Okay. Members, remember we have meetings on, you should have an email from my office about your meeting time on Thursday. And the committee is adjourned.